Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
So Cleve and Aaron, I don't know if you've heard about our new listener survey for Washington Post podcast listeners, but if you're listening to our podcast, you should be filling out our survey. Have you guys filled out our survey yet?
I have not filled out mine yet, but I hear everybody's talking about it.
I've not filled out mine yet either, and I think that's because I was not told a dollar amount that I could win.
Yes.
Just putting that out there.
That is the big news about this survey. So we are looking to get information about our listeners and where and how they listen, what they like to listen to, how they think our show could be better. But Cleve, as you pointed out, the thing to note here is that if you fill out our survey, there's a chance that you could win a gift card up to $1,000, which is a big deal. And to do that, you have to go to washingtonpost.com/podcast survey. Tell me the link again.
WashingtonPost.com/survey.
No.
Oh, you got it wrong. WashingtonPost.com/podcast survey.
Aaron wins.
Yay.
The $1,000.
Oh, yes. I could use that. That's good.
To be clear, employees of the Washington Post are not actually eligible for this prize.
Darn.
We are just joking.
Fine.
Okay. Well, thank you, listeners, for being game to do this. Again, to fill out our survey, go to washingtonpost.com/podcast survey. Welcome to the Campaign Moment. On this Friday, May 3rd, I'm Martine Powers, co-host of Post Reports.
And hello, I'm Aaron Blake, senior politics reporter and the author of the Campaign Moment newsletter. Rounding out our group this week is White House reporter Cleve Wootson. Thanks for being here, Cleve.
Of course, glad to be here.
So Aaron, tell me, what are we talking about today?
Well, the story that I think is really broken through this week is the campus protests that are taking place and what that says about the Democratic coalition and how this could potentially be an issue for President Biden in his reelection campaign.
So we're going to dive into that. I know we're also going to talk about some continued news on the Trump vice president front, especially some news about Kristi Noem. And also we'll touch on this week in the Trump trials. So with that, Cleve, I was hoping you could start by talking about what you're seeing when it comes to Biden and his approach to the campus protests.
I mean, his approach was as official as it can get, right? He spoke this week from the White House, from the Roosevelt Room, basically telling protesters to knock it off, right? That the things the protesters are doing, like stopping people from going to class or going to commencement or destroying property, they're not protected forms of speech. Let's take a listen.
So let me be clear. Peaceful protest in America. Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. It's against the law when violence occurs. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law.
What's really interesting to me is that the statement from Biden on Thursday was pretty strong. But it took him a while to get there. He didn't seem to want to touch this issue. But what we saw was the scenes at Columbia University, UCLA, they really kind of applied pressure. And so we saw kind of a growing chorus of Democrats coming out and saying very strong things about this, you know, basically saying that there should be harsh punishments for these protesters that went too far. And eventually, you know, Biden, who had just wanted to basically kind of say that anti-Semitism is bad and protests should be peaceful and wanted to leave it at that, was kind of compelled to get more involved in what is a very tense situation that I think in a lot of ways called out for presidential leadership. And now at least we have a little bit more of a sense for where he's coming from on these issues. Exactly how people respond to that is another matter, of course.
But one of the things that some Democrats and definitely protesters have criticized Biden about is not showing enough empathy or sympathy for folks in Gaza who are on the verge of famine, who are suffering. And, you know, now on the other end of it, I don't know that he's going into the main meat of that sort of argument as much as he is saying these actions that protesters are doing are wrong. He doesn't get into why the protesters feel that way. I would also add that one of the things that I pay really close attention to are the questions that Biden chooses to answer after the prepared remarks. The prepared remarks can be kind of predictable. They've been run through the ringer. A bunch of people have looked at them. But then reporters shout questions at Biden. And one of the questions that reporters shouted was, is this going to lead to any actual policy change?
Mr. President, have the protests forced you to reconsider any of the policies with regard to the region?
No.
I think, what is the purpose of a protest, right? The purpose of a protest is to change things, to have an impact, to get the attention of powerful people when you feel like you can't get their attention through regular means. And so the fact that Biden is just like, you know, I've seen this, I've seen protesters protesting, I've seen the outcry from other Democrats and all of that stuff, but they're still going to stay the course, I think is just a very sort of telling moment that things are not going to change and that we're going to see the ramifications of staying the course sort of play out maybe even over the summer and into the fall.
But I think one of the things that makes this so awkward for Democrats is how animated Republicans are about this. The fact that you had Speaker Mike Johnson going to Colombia last week, like calling directly for the president of Colombia to resign. You know, this is like what is leading Fox News, is the crazy liberal young people like running around taking over buildings, like setting up their tent camps. It's made it really dicey for Democrats to weigh into this because I think that they don't want to look like they're aligned with Republicans and how they're responding to these protests, but at the same time, like understanding how much this is a motivating issue for Democrat voters. And it's complicated.
And with a voting group that is already softening for Biden, with these young voters that already are casting increasingly wary eye on Democrats, to sort of side with the people that are arresting them and kicking them out of these buildings and shutting down their tent encampments, I can't believe that will do any favors for them come November.
It's really interesting to me. And one of the kind of benefits of figuring out who Joe Biden is as a politician is there's lots of stuff to draw on. This is a man who's been in office for many decades now. And what we've seen over the course of those decades is that not only is Joe Biden a very pro-Israel politician and has been for a very long time, that certainly came out shortly after October 7th, but he's also been somebody who's taken a pretty skeptical view of these kinds of protests dating back to the Vietnam War, certainly. And I think that kind of colors all of this as well. This is a guy who isn't necessarily of that counterculture in a lot of ways. And so it creates sensitivities where maybe he didn't want to speak out. He didn't want to come out and look like he was taking the side of, university officials and siding against these students because he's not really on the same page with those constituencies. And so it's an issue where it's an easy call for Republicans to say what they're saying about this. It's very easy for Mike Johnson to go to Columbia University and say what he did. But if you're a Democrat, and especially if you're President Biden with the history that I mentioned, it's a lot more difficult to say things that aren't going to anger the half of your party that sides more with Israel or anger the side of your party that sides more with the Palestinians. And so I think that's why we saw a lot of caution from him. But eventually, you have to say something when this is such a major issue and you're the president of the United States.
I actually don't know anything at all about Biden's history when it comes to the Vietnam War and like, was he part of the protest? Was he against the protest? Like, what are you referring to there?
He had a very colorful word for those protesters that we can't say on this family podcast.
Really?
It started with an A at one point. But I think that kind of speaks to that he is kind of an old school establishment Democratic politician. He's not from the Bernie Sanders era of the Democratic Party. He's not even from the kind of anti-Iraq war iteration of the Democratic Party, the politicians that kind of came of age in that era 2 decades ago. And so he comes at this from a very different perspective. And I think that's something that's kind of created some of these tensions that exist between him and those portions of the Democratic Party that are more kind of outspoken on these issues. And he's just not as comfortable doing that. Kind of like, you know, we've talked on this podcast how he's not as comfortable being a warrior for abortion rights necessarily, or even saying, abortion out loud. It's just not who he is as a politician. And so that creates some interesting dynamics.
Yeah, but I think that if you fast forward through history and you go to 2020, the summer of 2020, when folks were protesting in the streets of almost every city and town in America, you know, when Biden sort of emerged from sort of COVID seclusion, one of the first events that he did was he knelt with George Floyd protesters. Later at the Democratic National Convention, George Floyd's family spoke at the convention. And I think Biden has shown some flexibility, some fluidity in the ability to sort of stand on the side of protesters when he feels like it is the right thing or feels motivated to do so. It's just not happening in this circumstance because of what Biden has said is the ironclad commitment to Israel that does not seem to be sort of wavering.
Aaron, listening back to your conversation with Elahe on last week's episode of The Campaign Moment, one thing that really stuck out to me that I think, frankly, is very fair is the sense of, like, how much are Democrats at large sympathizing with these protesters? How much of this is coming off as just like a bunch of rich kids at like rich, fancy private schools who want to protest for a couple of weeks before they graduate? And I'm just curious, what's your sense from the polling in terms of how much this is really changing things for Biden or how much people are paying attention?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think we're seeing some kind of conventional wisdom creep in, at least among people who are maybe more sympathetic to Biden, that this is overblown as an issue, that these are elite college students who are taking part in these protests, and it doesn't really say anything about the broader electorate. We have seen polling that shows in the last few days that the war in Gaza ranks very low on the list of issues that people care about, and that includes younger people. It was something that was very important for about 25% of people who are under the age of 45. I think that's true, but I also think it's worth acknowledging that it's not so much that this is a big issue for like 100% of young people. It's that it's a huge issue for maybe a very small but potentially very important section of the electorate. And that portion of the electorate is one that Biden has really struggled with. His struggles with young people predated the war in Gaza, but it's just kind of another check of the box potentially against him if he doesn't get it right on this issue as far as those voters are concerned.
In some recent conversations with voters, I would agree that Gaza, the Middle East may not be their top issue. But I have talked with several voters over the last couple of weeks who've made this sort of nuanced argument that, you know, we can't afford to invest in American communities. We can't afford to invest in Black or other minority communities, but we are able to find billions of dollars to send across the ocean for a war that they don't necessarily believe in. I shouldn't quote Tupac, but like money for wars, but can't feed the poor.
I think relevant
is, I think,
to
something
feel
that one voter told me. So I would agree that it's not a lot of people's top line most important issues, but I think it also is sort of intermingled with sort of the other issues, the other grievances they may have against Biden.
Interesting. Well, I have another, like, are people paying attention to this question? But for the other candidate in this race, which is Trump, who continues to be on trial, I believe this week were days like 9, 10, and 11 of his trial in New York for falsifying business documents. And now that we are kind of in the middle of this trial, as things are playing out, you know, we heard from the former publisher of the National Enquirer last week. This week, we heard from Stormy Daniels' attorney. Aaron, what is your sense of, like, how much this continues to be on the radar of regular Americans?
You know, I don't know that it's penetrated yet. I think it still may, but these trials take a long time. And since we had David Pecker, the former National Enquirer executive, testifying last week, the testimony has been a little bit drier and more kind of incremental. We haven't seen Michael Cohen testify, for instance. We haven't seen Stormy Daniels testify. There was a poll that was conducted over the course of the first few days of the trial that showed less than half of people were closely following this trial. Only 15% were very closely following it. Independents were even less likely to be following it. So I think it's less a matter of, like, people are hanging on every word that's uttered in this courtroom where we can't see the cameras aren't documenting things, so it's harder to follow. I think it's going to be kind of a culmination of the weeks and when we start to get to more significant testimony. And then, of course, the verdict, which will be a very significant thing as well.
And Cleve, what is your sense of how much the Biden campaign is paying attention to this trial, or like how they're navigating how to talk about it?
Yeah, I have no doubt that they're paying really close attention. But whether they're trying to draw additional attention, I think, is sort of the big question. They're being very coy. For most of Biden's history, he's tried to be an above-the-fray politician. But there is a little bit of evidence that they're sort of going a little bit more, just a tiny bit more, into Trump's travails in New York. But it's very small things. There's like a couple jokes at the relatively lighthearted White House correspondents' dinner.
I had a great stretch since the State of the Union. But Donald has had a few tough days lately. You might call it stormy weather.
The campaign will put out, you know, things that say Trump is having a stormy time of it at the moment, or will say tongue in cheek that Trump has not held a campaign event for the last 2 or 3 days. And we all kind of know why that is. It is an attempt by them to sort of let Trump take the hits that come from a trial without Biden or Harris or whatever having to make those hits, to make those jabs, to just kind of let it play out. It's inflicting damage on its own. Just let it play out. Whether that tactic remains the same, whether Biden will sort of jab a little harder as time goes on, remains to be seen. But now it's just these sort of asides that insiders look at and they're like, oh, that's an allusion to the trial.
Mm-hmm. One of the big questions looming around this trial has been around the gag order. The judge in this case, Judge Juan Merchan, has been pretty concerned of Trump talking out of turn about individuals who are connected with this case, and his concerns have continued. Aaron, can you talk a little bit about the status of this gag order at this point?
Yeah, so the judge found Trump in contempt of court for violating the gag order on 9 occasions. Each fine was $1,000. That's the maximum that you can fine somebody. It's not the first time that Trump has violated a gag order. He also did so on 2 occasions in his civil fraud case. He potentially did so in another case as well, though he wasn't sanctioned for it. I think what's really interesting here is that we saw the judge in this case, Juan Merchan, issue the strongest threat to date of putting Trump in jail. Merchan said that he's only able to fine Trump $1,000 legally. But that may not be enough because that's a very small amount of money for Donald Trump. And he said, quote, because the court is not cloaked with such discretion, jail may be a necessary punishment. Basically saying, if Trump keeps doing this, that might be my only recourse because these fines are not going to do the job. And so it brings up a very kind of longstanding question about Trump's conduct in these cases of, would a judge actually do this? I think the conventional wisdom has been that they won't, because this would be a very shocking thing to do, to lock up a presidential candidate. But these judges also have the sanctity of their proceedings to mind. And if Trump were to keep pressing the issue with these gag orders and with his comments about people in the case, it may be kind of the only option that the judge feels that he has at his disposal.
All right, let's take a pause there. And then when we come back, we are going to talk about Kristi Noem, a pretty, frankly, horrible story about her dog, and how this might affect Trump's vice presidential pick. We'll be right back.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
So we wanted to spend some time this week talking about Trump's potential vice presidential picks, given the fact that we're nearing the time where he's expected to make that choice. But one piece of news that I don't think anyone expected that affects all of this came from Kristi Noem. Noem is, of course, the governor of South Dakota. She has a forthcoming memoir coming out soon. The Guardian was able to get an early copy of that memoir in which she tells this anecdote about her dog and basically killing her dog. Aaron, can you describe a little bit about what happened here?
Yeah, so basically The Guardian came out with a story this week about Kristi Noem, the South Dakota governor and vice presidential pick potentially for Donald Trump, in her own book talking about a situation in which she had a dog named Cricket who was unruly and attacking chickens and allegedly being a threat to children. And she just decided to take him out to a gravel pit and kill him. She shot him. It's a pretty remarkable kind of moment. You know, the Trump era has included many remarkable moments, but a potential vice presidential pick putting a story like this in a book that they publish on their own certainly ranks up pretty high there.
Which, of course, begs the question of, like, why? Why would she put this anecdote in her book? And I think that actually is a good question worth exploring of what she thinks this anecdote says about her or why, in her eyes, it was something positive to kind of brag about.
Yeah, so the way that she's described it is basically that it shows that she is able to do difficult things, that she's able to make difficult decisions and be politically incorrect in certain ways. Whether this is something that whether people view this as being politically incorrect and making a tough decision versus doing something that's cruel, I think is a very open question. As for the motivation for putting in the book, I think it's a really, really fascinating question. What we've heard from certain politicians in South Dakota is that this is a story that has been circulating and rumored for a while. Kristi Noem mentions in her book that after she killed the dog and also a goat right after that, she noticed that a construction crew had witnessed the whole thing. So it creates a situation in which potentially this kind of thing could have come out if she were a vice presidential pick. Things like this often do come out when you're a national candidate. And so maybe there's something to be said for kind of getting ahead of the story on your own terms. But certainly what we've seen is a pretty remarkable bipartisan backlash against her. The old kind of stereotype of a bad political attack ad is like, you know, attacking your opponent for hating puppies. Well, imagine being able to run an attack ad about somebody who actually killed a dog. But here we are, I guess.
But I just want to say that I find it in some ways like a little bit heartening that this is maybe the last remaining truly bipartisan reaction, which is that you're seeing both Democrats and Republicans, including Steve Bannon, including Donald Trump Jr., being like, you should not have done that. This wasn't a good thing. And I don't know. It feels like at least there's a floor for how we all as Americans are supposed to generally be nice to animals and especially dogs.
A fairly low floor.
Fairly low floor. You know, I was interested in how this issue could play politically, of course, because that's my that's my mode. And of course, there's the story of Mitt Romney and his dog who he put on the roof of the car during a family trip back. Seamus, yeah, this was a big story for a little while on the 2012 campaign.
For people who don't know this, can you just explain a little bit the circumstances of Mitt Romney and his road trip and Seamus, the dog who ended up on top of the car?
Yeah, so basically the Romneys have lots of children, and so there was not enough room in the car for the dog. And so the dog was placed on the roof for a quite lengthy trip. And Romney suggested that the dog was comfortable up there and that it wasn't a bad situation. But I believe there were certain things that happened over the course of that trip that would suggest otherwise.
I think the dog had indigestion, right? And therefore, the dog... Dogs need to go to the bathroom, and this dog went to the bathroom on top of the car, and it seemed like it was a pretty icky situation.
Yes.
Thank you for saying the hard part out loud.
Is this what cost Mitt Romney the presidency necessarily? Maybe not. But, you know, throw it on top of other things, and it's the kind of thing that maybe causes voters to question a politician's judgment and things like that, certainly.
So if we are operating under the belief that this might potentially take Kristi Noem out of the running for Trump's being his running mate, where does that leave us? Who else has started to climb the ranks in terms of their consideration?
You know, this is always a difficult thing because it's basically the opinion of one person that matters. And so we've seen kind of a large number of stories that are floating potential front runners. Recently, we've seen Marco Rubio's name reemerge.
Which is shocking to me. Like Marco Rubio, who had this whole like tit for tat about this like small Marco or
little Marco.
Little Marco, yes.
Trump's and then small hands.
Yeah. That it just seemed like their animosity toward each other had become very petty in the 2016 election. And so it's very surprising that they'd be willing to put that aside and become running mates.
Trump has proven that he's willing to look past things like that, as long as you like toe his line moving forward. Rubio maybe hasn't done that as much as others have, but also a consideration that my colleagues have isolated when it comes to Trump's VP pick is he really wants to win. And Marco Rubio checks a lot of boxes. He's Hispanic. He's a relatively establishment-oriented politician, so maybe that brings some of those voters back in. There is a very big issue here in that it's Marco Rubio's residency. They both live in Florida, and one of them would have to establish residency elsewhere if they want to get Florida's electoral votes, which Republicans will very likely need to win the presidency. So you create a situation where, like, either Trump has to establish residency back in New Jersey or New York, or an incumbent senator from Florida has to establish residency somewhere else, which is maybe a problem given that he represents Florida. And so this is kind of an X factor that also needs to be considered here. I don't know that Marco Rubio is necessarily a huge contender for Trump's VP, but that does seem to be one that people are suddenly focusing on again.
Cleve, who do you have your eye on in terms of potential VP picks?
I was interested in the rumors about J.D. Vance, actually, considering his book, which, you know, his criticism of Trumpism, and then that sort of about face that came where he was ultimately endorsed by Trump. It just seems like there's multifaceted and nuanced as well.
Well, going into this coming week, I'm curious for both of you, what do you guys have your eye on? What are you looking out for in terms of what could be the next campaign moment?
I think the big one next week is what's going to take place in the House, where Marjorie Taylor Greene insists that she is going to press forward with her motion to vacate against House Speaker Mike Johnson. So just a really interesting moment in the Republican Party's evolution where they're concerned about how this is going to impact the 2024 election, and they'd rather not be fighting with each other at this point. But of course, one member can force that issue and cause them to fight with each other, and she's proven that she's very happy to do that.
We will see over the next week Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and other people in the administration begin to fan out to college campuses for commencement exercises and commencement speeches. And I'm really interested in seeing what happens, whether these colleges or students show deference to the president or to the administration or whatever, or if they seize on this moment to protest in a bigger way that has a much larger platform, and how Biden reacts to that and just all that comes out of that.
So we will keep our eye on that. Listen, thank you guys so much for being here today. Cleve, it was a pleasure having you on.
Sure thing.
And Aaron, I will see you next week.
Thank you. And don't forget to subscribe to the Campaign Moment newsletter. You can find a link in our show notes.
Aaron Blake is a senior political reporter and author of the Campaign Moment newsletter. Cleve Wootzen is a White House reporter for The Post. That is it for this week's episode of The Campaign Moment. If you're tuning in via Post Reports, we'll keep bringing you these conversations on most Fridays, but you'll also be able to hear more from Aaron and our other colleagues by also following the Campaign Moment show feed itself. That is where we'll be dropping extra episodes as campaign news picks up. Be sure to look that up wherever you are listening to this podcast. Today's episode was produced and mixed by Ted Muldoon. It was edited by Renita Jablonski and Mary Jo Murphy. Our team also includes Maggie Penman, Rena Flores, Monica Campbell, Lana Gordon, Ariel Plotnick, Bishop Sand, Renny Svernovsky, Sabi Robinson, Emma Talkoff, Sean Carter, Peter Bresnan, Allison Michaels, and Alahe Azadi. I'm Martine Powers. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back soon.
Hey, parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.